Who has the last word? Let's talk about it as we go back to the basics. The last word. There's a TV show hosted by a guy who really talks a lot named O'Reilly. And he sometimes gives his guests, after he's beaten them up for long, long period of time, he says, give you the last word. And he gives them about 3 seconds to say something. Give you the last word, he says. I got an experience with the last word at lunch not so long ago. Marcia and I live within walking distance of the Avalon drugstore, and you can get the best greasy hamburger there. And I went over and sat up at the counter. If you've been there, you know that the women who take your order run that place. I don't know who owns it, but they run it. And in case you get crosswise with them, you're not going to eat that day. So you better be careful. So I sat up there, and I was hungry, and so the lady came up, and I said, I'll have a cheeseburger all the way, extra onions, with French fries and a large chocolate malt. And she stopped writing, and she said, you can't eat that much. And I said, excuse me? She said, you can't eat that much. No man can eat that much. I said, I can eat that much. She said, you're not going to eat that much today because I'm not going to bring you that much. I said, well, what will you bring me? She said, you got to choose between the French fries and the malt. I said, you can have the cheeseburger. You got to choose between the... I said, well, okay, I'll take the malt. You know, I realize I'm used to doing whatever a woman with a piece of paper tells me. It's just, she got the last word. I got the cheeseburger, and I'm going back one of these days when she's not there and just going to have the whole thing. But I'm going to have to get somebody. She got the last word, just like Bill O'Reilly normally does, no matter what he says. Who really has the last word in life? Is it the world or is it God? Now, Jesus claims to have the last word. He claims to have the last word. He said, as we saw last week, in the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Sometimes I believe that. I have a friend in Corpus Christi who, back when Marcia and I first got out of the Navy, used to come and ask me, what are you doing with the claims of Christ in your life? And I would say, what claims? He doesn't have any claims on me. And he said, oh, we need to talk. We need to talk. One of the claims of Jesus is that he has overcome the world. In fact, as we suggested, we can reverently paraphrase what he says by saying, the world is broken, and I have come to heal it one heart at a time. One heart at a time. And because of the power of what I have done in redeeming the world, if you will believe me, if you will trust me, and if you will obey me, then through you, I will become a force for healing in other lives. Now, that threshold question of do you believe me, do you trust me, will you obey me, is going to be asked over and again in the book of Joshua, because everything that Joshua did and the people who followed him accomplished, all was ultimately a result of their having said, this time we're going to believe you. This time we're going to trust you. This time we're going to obey you. Unlike the disobedience which cost us 40 years in the desert, this time we're going to get it right. Now, God's promise to us that we can become overcomers of life with Jesus is predicated on our answering yes to those three questions. Do you believe me? Do you trust me? And will you obey me? Now, as I was reading through the gospel and some other things this week, it struck me that one of the reasons we like the historical books like Joshua is because God is inviting us to enter into a story. He says, I am narrating this story continually. It's historical. It really happened, but I'm continuing to narrate, to tell this story today, and I'll tell it in and through you if you will just listen, if you'll just listen. And I also realize that God, being the ultimate realist, he tells us ahead of time that this is a story with a tragic beginning, but with a happy ending. Chambers says that sin makes life wild, and the basis of life is not rational, it's tragic, but with overarching hope, and the hope has a name, and the name is Jesus Christ. We're invited into this story of life, the story with a tragic beginning and a happy ending. And when we come into it, we realize that it's the tale of two trees. Did you ever think that all of history is narrated between the story of two trees? Polly, have you seen that? You know where the first tree is. The first tree, of course, is in the garden itself. Let's remember that together. We looked at it last week. Genesis 2:16. The first tree, the Lord God commanded the man, you're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. And we saw that the reason for that is that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is symbolic of man having lusted after the decision about what's right and what's wrong. God is saying you cannot judge what's right and wrong for yourself. Only I can do that, because I compare what is good and what is evil with myself. And if man ever decides to compare what is good and what is evil with himself, he will get it wrong every time. The first tree is a tree that brought death and hurt and curse and darkness and loss of dominion over all the earth. But the good news, friends, is that there is a second tree, and it, of course, contrasts with the tree in the first book of the Bible, the tree in the last book of the Bible, Revelation 22. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life. I'm so glad that you picked that song to sing, Vicki, this morning. We don't coordinate these things, but shall we gather at the river? It speaks right from this verse. Flowing from the throne of God and the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city, here it comes, on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nation. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. See, that's the second tree. We live our lives out between those two trees. First tree, we found death, the second life. The first hurt, and the second healing. In the first curse and the second blessing, in the first darkness and the second light, in the first loss of dominion. Did you see? They will reign forever. He's talking about us. That's the recovery of everything we lost in the garden. We live our lives out in a broken world, among broken people, between those two trees. Now, I know that you're thinking what I'm thinking. That's going to be great when we finally get to the second tree, but what do we do now? And that's exactly the question we're supposed to ask, because we are called by God to live in the meantime, what some people call the mean times. the time between the two trees, the time when Jesus says, this is a broken place, but I'm calling you to be whole people. And if you will believe me and trust me and obey me, I will make you whole as I am whole. But you've got to be willing to cooperate in the process. Now, as we said also last week, God is the ultimate realist. He causes us and calls us to look life squarely in the face, reality itself. That was illustrated for us last week again as we began to remember the background of Joshua, where Moses had brought the people up to the very shores of the promised land, and then he said, we need some good intelligence about the land. We've got to find out what it is that we're getting ourselves into and what God is leading us into. Would we have been better off if we'd had better intelligence about Iraq? Of course. People on both sides of the aisle would say that. It's vitally important to know what you're getting yourself into. Listen to these words again of Moses from Numbers 13, beginning with verse 17. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, go up through the Negev and on into the hill country and see what the land is like. Whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many, what kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees on it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land. It was the season for the first ripe grapes. Something written in the white spaces of the Bible here. God was implying through Moses to the people, look at life as it really is and see if you are prepared to handle it. Not the way you wish that it were, but the way it really is. Not the way it's going to be someday, but the way it is today. Can you handle life the way it really is? I was sitting on the front porch in Central Texas with a man whose first name was Red, and he was a great storyteller, and he loved to sit and whittle and spit and tell stories. And his grown daughter was sitting there, and all I had to do was just nod and say, uh-huh. It was one of those kind of conversations that's really a monologue. And he spun story after story, and finally his daughter said, Daddy, I can't stand it anymore. You are not telling it the way it really was. And he says, I know, honey, but who wants to tell it the way it really was? We're like that sometimes, aren't we? We don't want to see life the way it really is, but God, if we will allow him, will open our eyes and show us the way things really are. Now, God has a purpose in this. I think God has got twin alarm clocks here. One alarm clock is labeled despair, because when we see life the way it really is, we say, I can't handle this. But the second alarm clock is labeled rejoicing, because we can't handle it, but God can. And that's the reason he shows us the way life really is first, and then gives us the provision for living it in the power of the risen Christ. You and I have discovered Paul's secret. Paul's secret, of course, of living life the way it really is, he recorded in many places. Philippians 4:12 is one of the most familiar, where he says, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And here it comes. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Friends, this is not just a matter, like a friend of mine did in Corpus Christi a number of years ago, of electing God as chairman of the board of your corporation. and then saying, I don't intend to work anymore because God is going to take care of meeting the payroll and making all the decisions. This man actually did that, and he lost all of his money when God never showed up for the board meetings. God says through Paul, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It is God's strength. We've said this before, but let's remember how it works because it's important. Doing man's work man's way is humanism, and it is the great philosophy of the world. Doing man's work man's way. I did it my way, Mr. Sinatra used to sing. Doing God's work man's way is religion, formalized, structured, dead, empty religion. We're going to be on God's business, all right, but we're going to do it man's way. But it's neither humanism, man's work, man's way, nor religion, God's work, man's way, but it is the Christian life, which is God's work, God's way. Paul says, I've discovered the secret. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That power, that wholeness that is available to us because of Jesus, then begins to cause other people to see things differently too. I stopped this week and I said, if that's really true, what kind of broken world is it that we're called to be whole in? What kind of broken world are we to be in the process of literally becoming holy, literally evincing God-like qualities in the midst of all this mess? What is that world like? Well, I have a hard time understanding the answer to questions like that without specifics, so I'd like to share something specific with you this morning. It turns off of this. We live in a world where people can't tell the difference between right and wrong, and they use words to justify atrocity. People can't tell the difference between right and wrong, and they use words to justify atrocity. If you've read any of the stories of Slobodan Milosevic on trial, he is saying things that nobody can believe because the man, as far as we can tell, is a mass murderer, and yet he justifies. He chooses words in order to justify atrocity because he can't tell right from wrong. Marcia was reading an article this week in the Darfur region of the Sudan. 70,000 people had been murdered. Why? Because men acting on their own cannot tell the difference between right and wrong. They're not acting like beasts, to which level they have reduced themselves. They're acting like gods, to which level they have raised themselves. And they use words to justify atrocity. I'd like to share with you briefly from the New York Times magazine a few weeks ago the story of a woman. She has signed this article. I'm not going to use her last name, but I will use her first name. Her name is Amy. This story involves Amy discovering she is pregnant. And this is what she says. I'm now 34 years old, and my boyfriend Peter and I have been together 3 years. Now, we'll just make a few stops along the way. Here, obviously, is a woman who is deciding for herself what is right and what is wrong. I'm old enough to presume I wasn't going to have an easy time becoming pregnant. I was tired of being on the pill because it made me moody. Before I went off of it, Peter and I talked about what would happen if I became pregnant, and we both agreed we would have the child. So far, so good. But I found out when I went to my obstetrician, I was having triplets. Wow. The doctor finished telling me, turned off the sonogram. She said, are you sure you didn't take fertility drugs? No, I'm positive. My immediate response was, I cannot have triplets. I wasn't married. I lived in a 5-story walk-up in the East Village. I work freelance. I would have to go on bed rest in March. I lecture at colleges. My biggest months are March and April. I would have to give up my main income for the rest of the year. There was a part of me that was sure I could work around it. Remember that, please. But it was a matter of, do I want to? I looked at Peter and asked the doctor, is it possible to get rid of one of them? Or two of them? The obstetrician wasn't an expert in selective reduction, choosing words to justify atrocity. But she knew that with a shot of potassium chloride, you could eliminate one or more. I got on the subway afterward and felt ill. I didn't want to eat anything. On the subway, Peter asked, shouldn't we consider having triplets? And I had this adverse reaction. This is why they say it's a woman's choice. Because you think I could just carry triplets. That's easy for you to say, but I'd have to give up my life. She's right, by the way, about that. I have to be in bed 20 weeks. I just can't do this. I'd have to stop shopping at Costco and buying big jars of mayonnaise. And so I talked to a specialist and I told Peter, we're going to have a selective reduction. I found out I was carrying, when I went to the specialist, identical twins and a standalone. My doctors thought the standalone was 3 days older. There was something psychologically comforting about that, since I wanted to have just one. So I focused on relaxing. And Peter said to me, my gosh, as he looked at the sonogram, there are three heartbeats. I can't believe we're about to make two of them disappear. I had a boy. Everything's fine. But thinking about becoming pregnant again is terrifying. Am I going to have quintuplets the next time? I would do the same thing if I had triplets again. But if I had twins, I would probably have the twins. And then again, I don't know. Friends, there are six things about that I'd like to share with you. The first is this. We live in a world where the great enemy of wholeness is selfishness. I counted over 90 personal pronouns, either my or me or my, in that little article. The great enemy of wholeness is selfishness. What's in it for me? What are my concerns? What are my needs? What are my conveniences? And then the second thing is, follows closely on the heels of that. Conscience is silenced by convenience. Conscience is silenced by convenience. She said there was a part of me that was sure I could work around that. But do I want to? I'd have to be buying big jars of mayonnaise. Third, we live in a world where truth is recognized, but it's passed by. I'd have to give up my life, she said. There's a sense in which she was exactly right. If she'd had triplets, her life would have changed forever. There are many things that she wouldn't have been able to do that she would have had to sacrifice. She's right about that. And then her boyfriend, three heartbeats. I can't believe we're about to make two disappear. He was right. He should have stopped there. That was the fatal moment. We live in a world where truth is recognized but passed by. I reread the familiar story of the Good Samaritan this morning. The preacher and the lawyer see the man, it says, beside the road, and they pass by on the other side. We live in a world where the great enemy of wholeness is selfishness, where conscience is just silenced sometimes by convenience, where truth is recognized but passed by, and where we forth are constantly at the crossroads of decision. Do you ever feel like you live your life at a Y in the road, where you're always having to make decisions? On the subway, Peter asked, shouldn't we at least consider having triplets? You know whose role he's playing there? The role of Adam. Adam was right there when Eve was being tempted. He had obviously told his wife about the tree. The Bible doesn't say God spoke to her, spoke to him about the tree. He must have told her. The tempter comes to Eve, and the man fails to protect his wife. The boyfriend failed to stand up and said, we just can't do this. We're constantly at the crossroads of decision. Fifth, Muggeridge was right. All great evil is done in the name of good. All great evil is done in the name of good. You don't have to look at the bad stuff in life to see Satan at work. Look where things are ostensibly being done in the name of God. That's where the greatest evil is being done. And it's so easy, as Paul said, to cloak yourself with spirituality and make what you've already decided on your own to do sound like it's coming from God. And then finally, as we began by saying, we live in a world where we use words to justify atrocity. You can talk yourself into just about anything. And I'll tell you something really scary. You can find somebody who agrees with you too. As we saw last week, that's one of the great risks to leadership. I hope you are praying for both Senator Kerry and for President Bush, that whomever is elected president, that they will have people around them who will tell them the truth no matter what they want to hear. You know, there was something else as I read this over again this morning. One of the reasons I want you to know her first name, this is a recent article. I presume Amy is still around in New York someplace. Marcia and I are going to pray for Amy. Pray for Amy. See, nobody is beyond the reach of the grace of God. Nobody is beyond the place that the blood of Christ cannot cleanse them of all unrighteousness. Pray for Amy, that somehow the scales will come away from her eyes, that somehow she will be able to see who she is in the light of the cross. Pray for Amy. Well, we said there are two alarm clocks. One is when we look at life as it really is, awaken despair. One of the alarm clocks is working. That's a pretty bleak piece of work there. Where is the joy that the other alarm clock is supposed to symbolize if we have faced reality grounded in the truth of Christ? Well, here's a line from another bluegrass song that I heard this week. It's a naughty old world we live in, but the truth is we're only passing through. I have a friend who says her favorite verse in the Bible is, it came to pass. It didn't come to stay. It came to pass. There's going to be a time when this is all going to get straightened up, when every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. There is room in the heart of God. There is power in the cross of Christ to change even these kinds of situations. This is a naughty old world, friend, but we're just passing through. Muggeridge says that one of the great losses of Western civilization in the 20th century was the loss of the sense of transcendence. Just passing through myself. How about you? See, I'm bound for the promised land, friend. I'm bound for the promised land. Yes, we're here today. We're living in a broken world between these two trees, and we're called to be faithful and we're called to be whole, but we're just passing through. And then the second thing is this. Between those two trees, between the tree in the Garden of Eden where the trouble all started, and the darkness and the loss and the hurt began, and the wonderful tree of life spoken of in the book of Revelation that will come when Jesus returns, when everything will be made right again, all brokenness will be healed, all darkness dispelled, between those two trees, God leaves us little stories. Let me share one with you. Recently, a pastor came up to a friend of mine and said, you got a minute? And he said, well, sure. He said, you got time for lunch? He said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, today I do. He said, I'll buy the hamburgers. He said, great. So they went to lunch together, and as they were having their coffee, the pastor said, you know, I wasn't always a pastor. He said, oh, really? He said, yes, as a matter of fact, I've spent time in prison, some hard time, for some really bad things I did. And my friend said, well, tell me your story. He said, I never really knew my dad. What I remember was the beatings and how abusive he was with my mom. He left, as I recall, someplace around 6, maybe 7. And so I grew up and hit the streets and got in trouble, ended up in prison, met the Lord, got out, finished my education, went to seminary. I'm pastor of a church in California today. And he said, 60 days ago, I just became consumed with the need to find out if my dad was still alive. And so I hired a detective agency, and I won't bore you with the details, but finally I found him living in Beaumont. And I wasn't sure it was him, but I got a phone number, and I dialed the phone number one afternoon with a trembling hand, and when a man answered on the other end, I said, sir, you don't know me, but I want to ask you a question. Do you have a son named Bill? He said, I do. He said, I am he. And it was real quiet on the other end, and he said, Dad, would you like to know your grandchildren? He said, yes, I truly would. He said, I'll bring him to see you. So he got on the airplane and he flew to Houston and rented a car and drove to Beaumont and went over to his dad's house and introduced him to his grandchildren. And while the kids were out in the backyard playing, the pastor's son said, Dad, I got to confess something to you. I got a great job now and I got my life straight, but I haven't been a good man. I've been in prison. And his father said, so have I. And his dad said, which prison were you in? And his son said, the name of the prison. And his dad said, I was in that prison. Which unit were you in? And he told him the name of the unit. And his dad said, oh, well, I helped build that unit. I forged the bars that held you in. He said, son, can you ever forgive me? And he said, Dad, I forgave you years ago. It's time for you to forgive yourself. And he said, how can I do that? And I said, let me tell you about a friend of mine named Jesus. And he led him to Christ, and they have renewed a relationship in the twilight of his father's years that is deep and beautiful and whole. Who has the last word? Is it the world? Or is it God? Jesus said, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will will not pass away. But do you believe it? Do you trust Him? And will you obey Him? Let's thank Him. Father, today we're glad to be reminded, even as we listen to the New York Times telling a tough, tough story, that there is another side to this, that in fact we are just passing through, and between these two trees there are little stories that remind us that even amongst fathers who weld the bars that have held their sons in, there is a power that breaks the bars and that brings freedom and joy and wholeness, and that the Lord Jesus Christ is the life that is the light of men, and that that light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Hallelujah. Praise God.